Oh, it's the New Books and Food Podcast.
Hi, it's Alan Salkin from New Books and Food, talking to Dory Greenspan, the legend. I could give your bio. The most famous thing you're most famous for is writing the Julia Child book. You've won a million awards, et cetera. We're talking by Skype. You're in Connecticut?
I'm in Connecticut, snowbound, actually.
Really?
Well, I'm exaggerating just a little bit.
I was once literally snowbound in Squaw Valley, where you had a dig to open the front door.
Okay, then I exaggerated.
And snow came in on your feet, you know, on your head as you opened
the door. Ooh, no, okay. So I exaggerated a lot, not just a little bit. Yeah, it's all white out here.
What does a snowy day make you want to bake?
Oh, I have been baking like mad. So today I made ginger cookies, and I have the batter. I'm going to bake them right before dinner. I made matcha, or I hope I've made. It's a new recipe, matcha white chocolate madeleines. I made Parmesan biscotti. I made these little – I have been baking nonstop. These little Spanish cookies with this wonderful white meringue icing. Yeah, it's kind of been nonstop around here.
What do you do with a Parmesan biscotti? I think that biscotti is something that has really evolved in the last few years, partly because I think it's a dessert item that people who say they don't eat dessert will eat.
That's kind of a great way of looking at it. At some point, I remember people thinking that biscotti were health food, that they were low in fat. But, you know, a lot of biscotti have just as much fat as cookies. I think they're just delicious. And so these – I have two versions, one overbaked and one properly baked. And I'm kind of loving the overbaked because it's like – no, it's like cheese toast. And tonight I made onion soup tonight, and I'm going to float the I'm going to change their name. They're going to become Parmesan. Exactly. And put cheese on top of them and make them the top of the onion soup. But the other ones are not really dessert. I'm thinking about them with wine as an aperitif, a nibble before dinner.
To me, and you know more than I do, I'm sure, but to me, biscotti are one of those things, you know, served at Italian cafes, meant to be, you know, when you stand at the counter, because they don't sit in Italian cafes. They basically toss an espresso,
right.
Clatter the heavy china down on the white marble counter and get the hell out of there on their Vespa on their way to do something spectacular in the world of fashion.
Great description.
Yeah. So that's – a biscotti is something meant to be dipped, you know, and taken a bite of with – the sort of non-breakfast Italian breakfast.
Right. Or with Vinsanto, with a kind of sweet wine. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's a dipper. It's definitely a dipper. It's baked so that it's really crunchy almost. In French, they have a version of biscotti called croquant, and they're which just means crunchy. But sometimes they're called teeth breakers. So they're meant to be really hard, and they soften when you dip them.
So the newest book that came out in October 2014 is Baking Chamois. My French accent works on that one. Recipes from my Paris home to your home anywhere. So you have an apartment in New York, I guess a house in Connecticut, and what do you have in Paris?
I have an apartment in Paris.
Mm-hmm. And you've had that for 20 years or so?
Yeah, almost 20 years. Not the same apartment, but the same neighborhood, yeah. So we've been there for almost 20 years. Sometimes I think what I have in Paris is a Paris kitchen. Because that's – I live in – that's the room I live in. It changed my life to be able – I mean, Paris changed my life the first time I went, which is – well, it's more than 40 years ago now. I just put my feet down and thought, what was my mother thinking having me in Brooklyn? And Brooklyn was not hip and groovy then. I just felt such a connection to Paris. And then when we were able to become part-time Parisians and have this apartment, I really was able to really work with more chefs and learn more about the food and cook it every day.
We is who?
Oh, I have a husband. I got born and then I got married. Same guy, many years.
And I'm sure many people have said that he's a lucky man.
I'm a lucky woman, but just you made me think of something really funny. Eat Your Books, which is a website that indexes cookbooks. It's a great site. They indexed all my cookbooks, my blog, everything I've ever done for magazines, and wrote to me and said that they have indexed 2,500 of my recipes. And I said to my husband, whose name is Michael, I said, I can't believe that I created 2,500 recipes. And he said, I can't believe I ate them.
Yeah. Well, the Paris apartment, I mean, that is in a way your, you know, Paris is your, is in a way the ticket, that the thing that you most use as a source to write about. You're a sort of major translator of French cuisine to Americans, much like, of course, you know, Julia was. Did you have a Sol Meunier moment yourself?
I had a strawberry tartlet moment. So that first day that that I was in Paris, we bought a tiny little, it was called a barquette, so it's a boat shaped tartlet, and it was, you know, sweet pastry dough, vanilla pastry cream, and three teensy tiny strawberries, fraise de bois, wild strawberries. And it was so small, but Michael and I shared it. We were, I think we were doing, you know, Paris on $5 a day. And so I took that first bite, and nothing I had ever had tasted like that. It was remarkable for me. I had never tasted pastry that had that butter flavor. I'd never had European butter. The pastry cream, the vanilla in it, that was my Sol Meunier moment.
I'm not the first to have asked you that question. I just have to know.
Well, it's funny. You might be the first person. We all know that it was, you know, Julia's first trip to France when she had that Sol Meunier that made her fall in love with it. Yeah. And I realized, I mean, I knew how good that tartlet was, but I didn't understand how important it was to me until years later when I realized how often I was going back to it and what I was, you know, what I was looking for when I was creating recipes.
We'll have to ask you about the butter. What, you know, I was at a restaurant in L.A., and I wish I could remember the name. It's a fairly new one in a great space. And they were serving on the sort of cheese and charcuterie plate Normandy butter, almost as if it was like a cheese or something. But it was just, you know, it's, what is it made? It's made out of milk that's churned, you know, with some salt in it. And yet it is an entirely different thing that blows your mind. Now, I'm assuming you're not cooking every pastry with the finest Normandy butter, but even Irish butter is better. I mean, what do you use if you're cooking here? And, well, go ahead, just talk butter.
So I had and continue to have an obsession with butter. So sometime in, I don't know, I want to say 2000 or so, I was working on a book called Paris Sweets. And I was going to my favorite pastry chefs in Paris and talking to them about what they do and getting recipes from them. But in the beginning, you know, it's hard to get people to talk to you and to share their recipes. And so I went to someone I knew well, and that was Lionel Poulin, who was a legendary bread baker in Paris. And his shop is still there. And I said to him, Lionel, I'm working on this book and I want a recipe from you. And I know that he does only bread and three pastries. He does an apple tart, a flan, and a butter cookie. I said, I would love to have your recipe for the butter cookies. They're called punition, punishments. And he said, darling, I would love to give you this recipe, but you'll never be able to make it. And I had just finished writing a dessert cookbook with Pierre Hermé, who's, you know, he was the most famous pastry chef in Paris, now probably the most famous pastry chef in the world. And here's Lionel Paulin telling me that, no, I can't make his cookies. And I said, oh, but I can. You know, I did this, I did that. And he said, no, it's your butter. You won't be able to make it because your American butter just isn't good enough. And with that, I started on a quest to find out what it was about butter that was so very, very special. And I ended up writing a story for the New York Times about it. I just became crazy about it. So not to carry on for too long.
No, keep going.
So here's the thing about French butter. French butter has more butter fat. By law, I mean, even ordinary supermarket French butter has a minimum of 82% butter fat. American butter, by law, has to have a minimum of 80%. And you'd think that little 2% doesn't make a difference, but it does, because everything that isn't butter fat is just water or milk solids. The really great butters, the butters that are worthy of putting out on a cheese plate so that you can taste them, you know, if you wanted to, you could, you know, stick your finger in them and taste them all on their own and be blown away as you were. Those butters are cultured. And so the cream comes in and then it's left to ferment, cultured kind of the way sour cream is or yogurt, left to ferment for about 18 hours. And then the really good butters are then churned in small batches. So what you get is a butter that has a tang from that culture. That other butters, ordinary butters don't have. And the great butters, the butters that get an AOC in France have 84 to 86% butter fat.
So his cookies were made with what?
They were made with Échiré butter, which is an AOC butter, and, that has 84, 86% butter fat. So he said to me, you won't be able to do it. And I said, oh, come on. You know, I baked all of Pierre Hermé's recipes in America. I'm sure I can do it. And he said, okay, bring me, the next time you come, bring me American butter and we'll make these cookies together and I'll let you know if I can give you the recipe. And so the next time I went to Paris, I showed up at his doorstep with Land O'Lakes butter. Mm-hmm. And just as I was leaving New York and packing my butter with me, I thought, oh no, what if I get there? And he says, yeah, the butter is okay, but the flour isn't good. So I packed flour too. So the only thing he had to supply was the sugar and the eggs. And we made those cookies together and baked them in his gorgeous wood-fired oven. And it only takes 11 minutes to bake them, but those were such long minutes for me as I waited for his decision. And he gave me the okay and the recipe.
Oh.
Yeah.
So, I mean, is there a butter that's a little more exclusive than Land O'Lakes that you bake with?
Okay, so when I bake for publication, when I'm working on my books, I bake with Land O'Lakes or with Cabot, which is my local butter here, because Land O'Lakes is the only butter that's available nationwide. And so I want to use what my readers and other home bakers are going to be able to use. So I test all of my recipes with as much as I can with supermarket products so that I'm not going to get an email from someone in the middle of the country saying
like
they can't
Rachel
get it.
What you can get at the Price Chopper in Albany. Yeah.
Right. So, I try to do that. And then when when I'm not, or when I'm serving, you know, butter on a plate, I love Vermont butter. Vermont butter and Vermont Creamery, I guess, is now their name. Vermont Creamery butter, which is made just the way butter is made in Brittany, and has a very, very, it's cultured, has a very, very high percentage of butter fat. I think in California, a similar butter would be the Strauss Family Farm butter.
I was just last weekend, I was skiing up in, Waitsfield. I skied Mad River Glen, which is, you know, a great, I don't know if you ski, but it's a real throwback kind of place, and they were serving, I just ordered the bar burger there, and apparently there's a member of the Mad River Glen ski co-op, you know, it's a nonprofit, and he has some cows, it's called like Crazy Horn Cows or something to do with horns, and it was just this random burger, and you know, they serve also this Lawson's beer, which is legendary up there, but it was a grass fed with apparently a little grain, and I tasted the burger. You know, I love hamburgers. I've eaten how many thousands of them probably. And I was just, I couldn't stop. I tasted it and I took one bite and I was like, what's going on with this burger? How can this thing be so good? And, anyway, I kept raving and I probably thought I was a lunatic because it was just some guy working a grill at a ski resort. You know, but they cared and they knew the meat was good and it was the meat. Anyway, some of the Vermont products really are incredible. We also, by the way, we did visit the Cabot Cheese, factory store and got some of their hot habanero and crazy flavors. So they have some good products up there too.
They do. I mean, they really have farmers. I had a dinner at Dan Barber's, Blue Hill Stone Barns, yeah. And they served two butters, each from one cow, each from, well, okay,
single origin single, cow.
Single udder butter.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's so Dan Barber, isn't it? Yeah.
It's so Dan Barber. And one butter was really better than the other. And Michael said, boy, this butter must have come from a happy cow. And Dan said, you know, it's funny, it comes from Annabelle, and Annabelle was not a happy cow, and her milk wasn't that delicious, and then she had a baby, and she calved, and her milk changed, and that's her butter. Food is fascinating.
Oh, I know. It's you and I. I'm trying to get into writing about other things, and I keep coming back to food. I mean, you've well, where can I go with it? You know, let's talk about well, I mean, you know, 40 years, right? You've been doing this?
Well, no. I went to Paris, mm-hmm. and I wrote my first cookbook in 1991, a book called Sweet Times. But before that, I did a doctorate, all but dissertation, in gerontology. I worked at a research center. I taught third grade. Yeah, I taught all those kids that Amsterdam was the capital of Holland. It's not, you know. They're probably 97 years old now, and they still think it. I mean, I did a lot of things, and I didn't start writing about food until the mid-'80s.
It's the capital of the pot industry in Holland, is what Amsterdam is.
That's what I meant to tell them, right?
You should have, definitely. Which, you know, it's always a good way to make sure you enjoy your baked goods is to indulge a little bit. The reason I asked how long you've been in it is not just for a little bio, which is interesting. Do you get tired of baking?
No. No. It's it kind of fascinates me that I don't, because I bake just about every day, and I have for lots of years. I got married as a college student, and I hadn't cooked or baked, so I taught myself because we had to. My husband was working, and I was the one with free time, mm-hmm. and we needed to eat. And I discovered that I loved it, and then I kept baking. I would bake after school. I baked after work. I baked after work and school. But at the time, it was so unlikely for me to be able to work in food. Yes. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't a woman's field. It wasn't, everything was different. But I started because I loved baking, and it turns out I still, I'm not bored. Go figure.
In the book, there's a bunch of interesting recipes. I couldn't help but turn to the one that's called, is it Sunday in Paris chocolate cake? And one thing that interested me about it was the peanut butter.
Exactly.
I know in your recipe you talk about having a hard time finding peanut butter. It is amazing around the world. I think it really is easier to get Vegemite than it is to get peanut butter in a lot of countries.
It's certainly easier to get Nutella, in France. I was so surprised to see peanuts on the cake, and then when I got the recipe to find that there was peanut butter in it. Peanut butter is not a French ingredient. I mean, food in France is changing as it is all over the world. So it's a part of it is chefs coming to work in France from other countries. A lot of it is the internet. It's hard to put your finger on what is French food these days. But that recipe, so the pastry shop is so beautiful. It's called Un Dimanche à Paris, A Sunday in Paris. And they make their cakes in these very long, slender molds. Kind of like the runway model look of cake molds. And it really was a surprise to find those peanuts. At its heart, it's just a delicious classic French cake. But that the peanut butter and peanuts and caramel really change it.
Why are people still so interested in Julia Child?
That's a great question. I find it so comforting that people are, because there are so many food people of her generation that are not known by a lot of people. I mean, if the U.S. Postal Service hadn't, put out stamps of Edna Lewis and Philippe Rojas Lombardi, I don't know that people would know who they were.
Justin Wilson.
Yeah. There's a name that most people, I feel like Julia, not feel like, I know that she captured America's imagination. Jeff Drummond, who produced her last, her last TV series.
And Cooking with Master Chefs, I think.
Starting with that, that's right. And then going through Baking with Julia and the Jacques and Julia series. Jeff used to say that if Julia had decided to be, the weatherman, she would have been great at it. That she just had a wonderful presence on stage and on television. But she was... And that was really important. I don't think she could have touched as many people had she not, been on television and been so fabulous on TV. But she was a very serious, I almost want to say scholar. She worked so hard. She studied all the time. She was endlessly curious, and she always wanted to learn new things. And she gave us recipes that we were never, maybe we would have gotten it, but it would have taken us years to come to France the way she brought us France.
What role do you think you played in her legend?
Oh, I don't think I had much to do with her legend at all. At all.
You don't think that cookbook?
That cookbook was
another one in the
no.
chain.
No. That cookbook
Baking with Julia. We're talking about.
Yeah, Baking with Julia. So Baking with Julia accompanied the
TV
series, same name, and in the series there were 26 bread bakers and pastry chefs from across America who came and baked in Julia's kitchen, and I worked with them to organize what recipes they would make, and then I And then I wrote the book. But that was, you know, that you used the word translator before. Mm-hmm. And that's the way I felt. I mean, I did a lot of organizing on that book and certainly a lot, you know, all the writing, but, that book wouldn't have happened. I had, you know, I did the book, but I had so little to do with Julia's legend. That was a great book that stood on its own because yeah. it had great material. It didn't, you know, fabulous chefs who contributed recipes. It didn't need the, it would have been a great book without the TV series. It couldn't have existed without it. But no, I don't think I had anything to do with Julia's legend.
I'm Alan Salkin. We're talking to Dory Greenspan. Her new book is Baking Chez Moi, Recipes from My Paris Home to Your Home Anywhere. This is New Books and Food. And let me ask you, since I'm also doing this thing for About.com, it's cookbooks.about.com, and I'm not just trying to do roundups of new cookbooks because there's a lot of that going on. There's so many people who want to get into the game and – you know, there's so many – cookbooks is one of the few areas of publishing that's still making money and authors are still getting paid to do it.
May I just add, thank goodness?
Sure.
Thank goodness.
I'm we can speculate why, you know, it makes a great gift. There's something about just simply not spilling on your iPad that makes a book nice. The pictures – I'm not sure what it is. But what do you think you – what are a few of the most important things about writing a cookbook that people may not know? Or what makes yours special and different?
It's hard to say what makes mine special and different. I know what I work really, really hard on. And that is writing recipes, testing the recipes so that they work. I'll just go back and tell you a quick Julia story. When Julia was, when Baking with Julia was published, and if we were separate and Julia was traveling for the book, she would call me every day at the end of the day, and here's what she would say. The recipes worked. She was, for her, that was the most important thing. She said, I was at the Junior League in, I don't know where, and they made that three-story, you know, wedding cake, and everything worked perfectly. When you're writing cookbooks, I mean, I love the writing. I love the storytelling, and I love to be able to tell stories with each recipe, to ground the recipes either in a person, a tradition, a culture, to have a story to go with them. But what's so important and so hard to do in a cookbook is to get the recipes right, to nail them so that someone who's never seen that chocolate cake before, who has only your words to go by, can succeed and make something he or she loves. And that's really hard work. And I don't know that it's the kind of thing that I think somebody who hasn't worked on a cookbook doesn't really understand just how much time goes into when you're creating a recipe, creating it, reworking it. I mean, I have those Parmesan biscotti on my table, those two different versions, but there were two different versions before that. So it's that constant reworking. And then the actual writing of a recipe is also difficult. I mean, I try and imagine myself kind of sitting on a home baker's shoulder, partially being a cheerleader. Come on, you can do it. You can do it. Being encouraging, but also trying to think of everything that could go wrong. Every moment where, you know, a batter might look curdled, but I know it's going to be okay, to give the baker a heads up. There's a lot of you know, really behind the scenes work that goes into a cookbook.
I think that's a very important point. And to get even more subtle about it, what is it about you in particular that makes you, because The Barefoot Contessa, Ina Garten's cookbooks are well known also for working. That's the key. People love her recipes. Those cookbooks work. And she also doesn't leave a lot. I assume you don't leave a lot in other people's hands. It's you do it again and again. And I think that's what Ina does. She cooks things again and again obsessively and works hard. And, you know, and I, even as a writer, I think one of the keys to why I have had some success is that sense of you really can't assume. I'll just tell you, in my case, I feel like it's some kind of weird, almost codependence of like a psychology of not, of being brought up, maybe even not trusting people and not trusting advice. And, you know, I even complain about the signage in New York. You can never find where you're going because the signs are bad. If you're not from New York, you cannot work the subway system. So signage, and I think that, you know, it's what you're talking about in a way, signage, it's instruction. What is it you think that creates this desire to go to that length? Because your cookbooks are beloved, and they wouldn't be if they didn't work, you know, and you go turn to these things again and again. You understand how they work. You know, it's clear that even that the fonts are good, the index is well spaced.
You know, it's so you're pointing out so many interesting things, Alan. It turns out that I, for many years, I worked alone, and 5 years ago, I started working with someone who actually lives close to me in Connecticut, Mary Dodd, and she's been testing my recipes. And the way I work with her is that when I think the recipe is perfect, that's when I send it to her. And she tests both. I always think that she's testing two things. She's testing the formula and making sure that, you know, all the ingredients are right. But she's also testing the instructions. You know, are they clear? And, you know, does she get hung up on something? Do I need to clarify something? And it's been incredibly helpful to me to have somebody else looking at that. But it's interesting when you say you don't trust. I feel like I'm a very trusting person, but I'm a worrier, right? You know, I walk around, my husband and son stop me all the time and say, look at yourself, look at yourself, look at your brow. It's all furrowed. What are you worried about?
It keeps you thin.
Well, I'm just, you know, I'm always worried. So I think that, in writing my recipes, I'm trying so hard. I don't want anybody. I want everybody to be happy. I want everybody to get it right. And so there's some of that. The other thing is that I try my recipes. It was funny. Julia said to me, you write recipes just the same way I do. And I said to her teasingly, but I meant it. I said, do you mean long?
Right.
And I write very long recipes.
Yes.
Because I want people to have all the information, but also I want to have a conversation with the home cook and the home baker. I don't want my recipes to read like military instructions, you know, do this, do that, you know, mix, stir, bake. So I try to speak through my recipe instructions to the baker to be to be conversational, to be able to feel a connection to the bakers. And I know that the nicest thing that people say to me is that they feel like I'm with them when they read my recipes. And that means a lot to me.
Here from page 127 is a pear tart with crunchy almond topping. This is how it starts. I just randomly turned to this. The topping of this tart has crunch, color, and flavor, and it could be a show stealer, but it's not, colon. The pears, caramelized in butter and sugar, inflamed with brandy, more than hold their own. You know, it's just good writing.
Thanks, Alan.
Clear.
Thank you.
You know, and it's the flamed. Flamed is a verb. Nice.
Thank you. I had a friend who for many years wrote for the Wall Street Journal, and I would say to her, writing is so hard. How do you do it? And she said, Well, I try and crack myself up at least once every 3 hours. And sometimes when I'm working on not so much the introduction to the recipes, but the recipes themselves, where it's, you know, it's almost technical writing. I think of Mary and think, okay, I've got to crack myself up and just have a little fun, make up a new word or try and describe something in a way that I haven't heard it described, before.
Yeah, I had a debate with the last person I interviewed for this was Brian Voltaggio, chef in the Maryland area. His brother's Michael in L.A. And he was trying to give me this crap about chefs not being artists. And I just, you know, some aren't artists, but what you're talking about is artistry. And, you know, the good ones bring you all the way there. They don't leave you halfway. You know, Dan Barber can talk as much as he wants about, you know, the names of his cows, and that, you know, he has a great story he tells about this one pig, but they didn't know whether they should kill him or not because he was in pain, and neuter him, and a whole great, you know, Dan's a great storyteller.
Wonderful storyteller.
If his food didn't taste good.
I agree with you completely. Yep.
It's not just the idea, it's what's on the plate and does it taste good. And I think, you know, obviously I was lucky enough to eat at El Bulli, which I talk about too much. And not only was it crazy stuff, but it was delicious.
It's one of my regrets that I didn't. But, you know, somebody – when I can't think of who said it and what the context was, but it might as well be dinner. It doesn't come with subtitles.
Right.
So – you know, somebody can talk about their philosophy of cooking or whatever. If the food, as you said, doesn't deliver, then it's, you know, it's not the whole package.
Let's talk for a second about shopping. You know, French food, most of the great cuisines are about simplicity. And I know that was one of your goals in this book, Simple Desserts. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's everything simple if the ingredients, you know, I mean, on TV, everything's in the little mise en place dishes and they just dump it all together and it works. But, you know, even for me, I have a Whole Foods. I mean, I'm in Manhattan and it's almost across the street from me on Bowery. But, you know, gathering the ingredients and having them at hand, that it's simple once it's all up five flights of stairs, it's ready to go. And you have a stove that works, and you have an oven that's the right temperature, and you know, if you're living in a European country, I don't know. What you think about how do you make it? How can it be made simple with an American lifestyle that just isn't?
Oh, that's a big question. So having been, I guess I shouldn't say I'm snowbound. I'm just maybe homebound. The other day I was baking. What was I making? I think I was making biscuits. And I thought, life is good. I open the refrigerator. I have 6 pounds of butter. I have 2 dozen eggs. I had apples. I made a tart later in the day. And I thought, when everything is there, life is good. So I kind of get a little high from having all of these ingredients around me and then just being able to do whatever I want with them. But it is complicated to live in a busy world and to cook even simply or maybe especially simply. I have never learned to shop for the week. So I shop daily.
Which is how it's been done for most of human civilization.
Yeah, but we don't have to do that now. I do it mostly because I'm so disorganized. I never know what I'm going to make, and I can go to the store with a list and come back with, you know, nothing on my list and a whole new menu. I feel like shopping and choosing the ingredients is a pleasurable part of cooking. It's hard. You're right.
And you generally, in Paris, I'm assuming you walk your groceries home.
That's right. And I do in New York City.
Right, but and in Connecticut you drive them. It's such a pleasure sometimes when you don't normally have a car to drive to the supermarket and not have to carry your stuff a few blocks.
Yes, and it's also, you know, I'm a city girl. I was, you know, born in Brooklyn. I lived in New York for, you know, a trillion years. I'm getting used to being in the middle of nowhere, and one of the things that I find difficult is getting in the car. Being a half hour from a quart of milk, especially since I'm so disorganized. But
you don't have any you don't produce any food at your house?
I'm sorry, I don't.
You don't have any cows or goats or cows?
No.
Or, yeah, okay.
No. Ducks out on the pond. That's it.
But no duck eggs.
No duck eggs, no.
Before we wrap up, you've been doing a lot of things online. You're still doing your weekly baking club, or what's?
Oh, you know, so the club is so interesting. It's not my baking club. I'll tell you this quickly because it's a great story. When Baking From My Home to Yours came out in 2006, shortly after it came out, I got – and the internet was newer then than it is now.
Yep.
I got – maybe in 2007, I got an email from a woman in Pittsburgh named Lori Woodward. And she said that she had just gotten my book and she loved it. And she and two other friends wanted to bake their way through it. Was I okay with that? And they were going to start blogs and they would post what they baked on their blogs. I thought, gee, that's really exciting. Isn't it wonderful that she loves my book and she wants to do that? And I said, sure. Having no idea what that would mean, no idea that three would become 300. At some point, there were a lot more than that. She called her group Tuesdays with Dory, and they baked their way through all 300 recipes in Baking From My Home to Yours. When my next book came out, Around My French Table, they started a new group called French Fridays with Dory, and in April, they'll have finished cooking their way through Around My French Table. And now they're almost finished with Baking with Julia, and they've started on Baking Chez Moi, my newest book. So this is a group that I didn't start. It was an organic group that started and has continued now for, what is it, 7-8 years?
How do you part? Do you ever visit, or do they come to your house, or what's your interaction?
No. So I still, sadly, have never met Lori.
Hmm.
But when I am on book tour, I get to meet some of the members of either Tuesdays with Dory or French Fridays with Dory. I met a lot of them when I was out on tour for Baking Chez Moi. And I was at a bloggers conference and 20 of the members of the group came. So we did get to meet one another and we exchanged Christmas cards. And I visit their website. They come in, you know, they visit my blog. We're on Instagram and Twitter back and forth. But it's a fabulous group of people. This part is the messages that I get from so many of them. There's one guy. They're all women. Trevor's the guy. So many of them joined to learn to bake. They had wanted to bake. They were afraid of baking, and they thought this would be a good way for them to learn to bake. And I get the most wonderful letters from members saying that they have become, you know, good bakers, they've become better cooks, and that learning to bake and feeling so good about what they've done has really helped them in other parts of their lives. It's remarkable. The group is incredible, and it's open to everyone. No rules, no regs. You just bake and post.
It just shows you, if you polish any area of your life, the rest of the areas will shine. I'm looking in the index of baking chamois, and it goes from Parisian macarons to passion fruit coulis, which means there's no Parmesan in here. So that means the Parmesan biscotti are for your next project. What is that?
It is. It's a cookie book. So I'm working on a book of cookies, both sweet and savory. So I'm thinking our son, Joshua, and I had a brief, a wonderful but brief cookie business. And we did a collection of what I called cocktail cookies. And so I'm going to do some of those for the new book.
With alcohol in them, or to dip into alcohol, or have with alcohol?
Exactly, to dip in or to have with. Though some of them might have a little bit of booze.
Such a pleasure talking to you. I hope I see you at our paths cross again. I think I last saw you in Aspen.
That's it. That was time to see one another again. This has been so much fun. Thanks, Alan.
This is New Books and Food, part of the New Books Network at newbooksnetwork.com, where there are interviews with authors on every subject you can imagine. It's a great site. Check it out to find recipes and other material related to what we talked about today. Check out cookbooks.about.com, the about.com website for which I am the cookbooks and food writing expert. My website is allensalkin.com, A-L-L-E-N, S like Sam, A-L-K-I-N. All my social media is Alan Salkin. Also, Instagram, Facebook is facebook.com/Salkin. Twitter is Alan Salkin. I think you can find me. Guess what? My name's Alan Salkin. Thanks for listening.